This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeis Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Urban refugees are facing job losses as businesses are forced to downsize or close due to COVID-19 restrictions. For many, we're daily wage workers or work in the informal economy and were already living hand-to-mouth before the pandemic struck.
That's the spokesman for UNHCR on the exploitation of urban refugees who fall in debt and are forced to take desperate measures to survive. Details coming up. Also, South Africa's president takes decisive steps to end his country's hard lockdown. And a quarter of a million people, the majority of them children, are fleeing intense violence in the DRC. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. First, our top story. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has taken the most decisive steps yet to end his country's hard lockdown, which at 60 days is the second longest in the world after Italy's. He maintains the restrictions have been successful in curbing the spread of COVID-19 to allow health systems to strengthen ahead of an expected surge in casualties. Although the Ramaphosa administration has now freed up most economic activity, business analysts warn South Africa may never recover from the damage done by the lockdown. Darren Taylor reports.
Wholesale and retail trade will be fully opened, including stores, spaza shops, and informal traders. E-commerce will.
Ramaphosa makes the announcement that South Africans have been waiting for. But the leader of the opposition Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, says easing the lockdown is 6 weeks too late.
I think it's come at a tremendous price for the country, but nonetheless, I'm glad that we are moving towards opening up the economy so that we can deal with the twin threat to lives of South Africans and the spread of the virus, as well as a grinding economic depression. Although it does look like we are not going to be able to avert an economic crisis. And that the
futures analyst Marius Oosthuizen says the economy was in crisis long before COVID-19 hit. The virus and corresponding lockdown simply worsened it.
Unless government combines its fiscal stimulus for the health crisis with a fiscal intervention on the productive side of the economy, we will begin to go into a similar spiral to what Argentina has had, where low growth with rising debt means we go through a series of defaults, which in the end put the country at greater socio-economic risk and threaten the democratic fabric of the country. And so we would want to.
The spokesman for the Business Unity South Africa group, Kas Kuvadia, says easing the lockdown restrictions will result in much more than an economic boost.
One of the advantages of opening up the economy that we've always said is that it enables business to get involved in screening people. If people are showing signs, then they can go for testing. And what's happening is we're picking up more people who are positive. Otherwise, they would not have been picked up if those businesses would not be open.
But smaller enterprises say they don't have the money to buy equipment such as thermometers to screen their workers or for the chemicals needed to deep clean their premises. Nevertheless, as many celebrated a return to a semblance of economic normality, Ramaphosa indicated that the suffering would continue for thousands of other business owners.
To ensure that we maintain social distancing, certain high-risk economic activities will remain prohibited. These include places such as restaurants, bars, taverns, accommodation, and domestic air travel.
Many of these enterprises would not be able to reopen anyway, as the lockdown has already ruined them. Some owners have ended their own lives. Others are now destitute. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The UN Refugee Agency warns hundreds of thousands of urban refugees across the East, Horn, and the Great Lakes region of Africa are resorting to desperate measures to survive as the economic impact of COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus, takes hold. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Government-imposed lockdowns and curfews aimed at preventing the spread of the coronavirus are restricting everyone's freedom of movement and ability to earn a living. The UN Refugee Agency says urban refugees are most seriously affected by the measures and unable to meet their most basic needs. UNHCR spokesman Charlie Yaxley says many urban refugees are at risk of exploitation and falling into debt. He warns many may be forced to take desperate measures to survive, such as engaging in transactional sex or child labor.
Urban refugees are facing job losses as businesses are forced to downsize or close due to COVID-19 restrictions. And many were daily wage workers or worked in the informal economy and were already living hand-to-mouth before the pandemic struck. Many urban refugees are also living in overcrowded and unhygienic conditions and are particularly vulnerable to the spread of the virus.
Yaxley says thousands of refugees in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, are crammed into squalid districts with little access to clean water, making hand washing nearly impossible. He says governments across the East, Horn, and Great Lakes region so far have included refugees in COVID-19 response plans. He tells VOA refugees have the same access to testing and treatment as members of the local communities.
So our call today is for governments to also ensure that refugees are included in social safety nets so that they are able to access welfare support payments, so that they are able to get assistance with meeting their basic needs, so that they're able to pay rent for their shelters, so that they're able to afford food.
The UNHCR says food imports have become more challenging because of the pandemic, causing prices to rise. Additionally, it says swarms of locusts, especially in Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia, are ravaging crops and threatening to increase hunger and poverty. The agency is urging the international community to support its emergency response plan. It says $126 million is required to provide life-saving assistance before the rapidly deteriorating situation in the region reaches a breaking point. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says over a quarter of a million people, the majority of them children, have fled intense violence in Ituri province of the Democratic Republic of the Congo since the beginning of the year. Mavis Ochera in Ghana has the details.
Already 200,000 people have fled Dugu, Mahagi, and Irimu areas and sought shelter in host communities and overcrowded displacement sites in and around Bunia, Ituri's capital, since the end of last year. Pierre Barry is the UNICEF Chief Field Operations for the Democratic Republic of Congo. He says, although the COVID-19 pandemic has not stopped conflict in the DRC, the violence has escalated in recent weeks.
As an example, we can use the latest and I think maybe the worst, which is the situation in Ituri. In Ituri, during the past weeks, we've seen a new wave of violence, judicial violence and inter-ethnic conflict, and it's affecting the whole province. Recently, the situation has significantly deteriorated, especially since January 2020. So we are talking about targeted assassination, ambush, robbery, rape, and they are characterized by massive, indiscriminate, and violent attacks on civilians.
He says the situation is putting further pressure on already stretched humanitarian services in one of the poorest, most insecure, and disease-stricken parts of the country. Barry says out of 200,000 people who have been affected by the situation, about 58% of them are children. He says humanitarian organizations are overwhelmed with a new influx of people at displacement sites, especially in Bunia.
So when you look at Bunia and surroundings, we are talking about host communities, we are talking about camps, which were there during the last crisis and are still there, and now we are looking at new influx. And this new influx, even if we kind of knew it was going to happen, is massive. So the response is not ready. And if you look at humanitarian assistance in Ituri, we were stretched with our capacity, and now it's getting even worse.
He says more than 100 people died in the violence, and that the security situation has forced about 70% of humanitarian workers to leave the affected areas. They're able to work in Bunia because it is relatively peaceful. Birit says the violence has destroyed 22 health facilities across the province, wiping out last stock of vaccines, and 163 schools have been damaged or looted. He says 25% of children will not have classrooms to go back when schools reopen. Birit says the violence has reduced access to potable water, and there is a risk of waterborne disease such as cholera. UNICEF has treated more than 4,000 children under 5 suffering from severe acute malnutrition. Berry says it has built and rehabilitated latrines, showers, rubbish dumps to provide more than 21,000 displaced people with access to drinking water, hygiene, and sanitation.
We're also looking at malnutrition, unfortunately. Malnutrition is also getting much higher because of all those violence and movements, so we're trying to take care of those children. And we're also, as we mentioned, trying to see how we can accommodate and increase the capacity of the camps to get more water and provide better system of sanitation.
He says UNICEF is appealing for $262 million for the DRC, but as of May 15th, only 5.5 have been received. About 29 million was carried forward from the previous year, leaving a funding gap of $229 million. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Ghana.
Hundreds of Russian military contractors in Libya were evacuated yesterday after retreating from fighting with the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army on the capital's front. Forces loyal to the UN-recognized Government of National Accord, backed by state-of-the-art Turkish military support, recently achieved major successes against the LNA, led by General Khalifa Haftar, including retaking Al-Watiya Air Base, the last remaining LNA base in western Tripoli. Would that pave the way to end the Libyan civil war or force Egypt and the UAE to escalate their military support of Haftar? VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the latest developments in Libya with Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché to Libya and senior security analyst of the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations.
Currently, Turkish-supported Operation Volcano has clearly the upper hand, as it was demonstrated during the last weeks and in particular during the last days. The key question is, where is the red line for Egypt? Egypt will certainly not accept Turkish-backed Islamist forces on its western border. Days ago, a few MiG jets have arrived in Al-Jufra Air Base in central Libya. They are not enough to turn the tide, but it seems to be the LNA and its international backers try to play on time by deploying these sophisticated, more or less sophisticated jets to Libya. We'll see what they do thereafter.
What are the major consequences of a continued civil war in Libya for regional and international players?
As it looks now, Operation Volcano and Turkey will foster their control at least over western Libya. This means that Turkey is close to securing its economic and political objectives in at least western Libya. And Libya is of particular high importance for Turkey's broken economy. So it looks very well for Turkey. On the other side, the consequences for Egypt, if there is a military escalation between Ankara and Cairo over Libya, because of its location as a neighbor, Egypt is in a geostrategic much better position. It's much easier for Egypt's military to intervene and sustain forces in Libya than for Turkey. Therefore, as Egypt and the other supporters of the LNA, namely the Emirates and other Arab countries, have all the military means to defeat Turkey in Libya, it is just a political decision, a critical political decision, where Egypt draws the red line and how far Egypt wants to use military means to protect its interest. One of the losers of the current situation in Libya, developments in Libya, is certainly Europe. Turkey, as a dominating political and economic force in Tripolitania and Fezzan, has a huge negative impact on European strategic interests in Libya. It can be assumed that Turkey will become the favored economic partner of at least Western Libya, and this will strongly undermine the position of the various European stakeholders, in particular of Italy and France. Turkey will also get a much more dominating position on the European gas market. A few important gas pipelines are running already through Anatolia, through Turkey, and now they will also have more or less the Green Stream pipeline running to Sicily, also under their control. Furthermore, and also of significance, of particular significance, is that Turkey will control, in addition to the eastern Mediterranean migration routes, now also the central migration route towards Italy. Altogether, this will significantly increase Turkish possibilities to pressure the European Union.
How about Russia?
With regard to Russia, we'll see in the next days. A couple of Russian fighter aircraft has shown up in central Libya. It is not yet clear if those aircraft were provided directly by Russia or if they were provided through a third nation. If Russia is going to send and sustain fighter aircraft to support the LNA, Russia will certainly seek to maintain its influence in eastern Libya. It needs to be seen if Russia is willing to deploy a sufficient amount of military assets to achieve these objectives.
With no UN, US or European Union's involvement, what are the possible scenarios in Libya?
An escalation of the civil war is very likely. This escalation will either lead to a defeat of the LNA, which is currently more likely, or an Egyptian-Arab intervention. A lasting ceasefire at the current position is highly unlikely, as Operation Volcano has the upper hand and they won't give the LNA, understandably, the time to recover. After the defeat of the LNA in Tripolitania, a lasting ceasefire west of the oil-rich Sirte Basin is also unlikely, because there is simply too much oil in the oil crescent. Misrata and the Islamists supporting the GNA are eager to return to Benghazi, where they were defeated a couple of years ago by Marshal Haftar. And most important, of strategic significance, if the East would separate from Western Libya, Turkey's President Erdogan could forget about his maritime agreement with Libya, which is of crucial importance for Turkey and its intended exploration of gas in the Eastern Mediterranean. So altogether, it's rather likely that we will see some more fighting in Libya in the future. It could even well be that we are at the beginning of a new phase of the war in Libya.
That was Wolfgang Poschta, a former Austrian military attaché to Libya and senior security analyst of the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The U.S. Africa Command said in a statement today that it monitored as Russia recently deployed military fighter aircraft to Libya to support the Russian state-sponsored private military contractors backing Haftar's forces. Two Zimbabwe journalists were ordered today to pay 500 Zimbabwean dollars in bail and are to be freed from police custody after 4 days. Freelance reporter Frank Chikawere and Sam Takewira of 263 Chat were arrested last Friday and charged with violating the coronavirus restrictions. They were detained after they went to a hospital where three opposition party MDC members were being treated after being abducted and beaten. The lawyer for the two men says their arrest was a violation of human rights. Timely refuse collection, clean running water and basic service delivery have always been elusive goals for urban municipal councils in Zimbabwe. Now, more than ever, councils are being asked to deliver services to help fight COVID-19 spread. But councils say the pandemic has brought new challenges. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi has the details.
Josiah Makombe is the mayor of Gweru and the president of the Urban Council Association of Zimbabwe, which represents all urban councils in Zimbabwe. He says the situation is dire.
Generally, all local authorities have been affected badly. You know, our economy is large formal, and these are the people that own properties across all urban centers. Because they are on lockdown, it has been difficult for local authorities even to provide the services that we are supposed to give our people.
He says the Urban Council Association has been talking with the national government to work out a solution.
We've approached government to say, please, can you come on board and you close the gap? We seem to have a crisis whereby local authorities are supposed to provide essential services during this lockdown period. We no longer have the capacity. That assistance has not been forthcoming.
He says most local authorities have not been able to pay their frontline workers. Other workers have gotten half their salaries. This is happening against another wave of price increases in the past week. He says central government's lukewarm response has prompted them to look elsewhere for help.
It's really bad. We have realized that our government is not taking it seriously. But as local authorities, we are not only looking at government, we are also engaging our partners. For instance, most local authorities have been running out of water chemicals, and we have engaged UNICEF, and they promised to supply each local authority with a month's supply.
Makombe is hopeful that by the time the UNICEF supply of chemicals runs out, the national government will have pitched in. He urges residents to also pitch in and pay their bills to help keep the councils operational. He says what makes the situation tougher is that councils, councillors and mayors have been left out of the government's COVID-19 task force, although they are the ones in touch with the people. The national government has taken over council clinics as part of the coronavirus response, but Makombe says it defies logic to take over the clinics but not involve council in the task force. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Kenya has stepped up efforts to find a local treatment for COVID-19. The Kenya Medical Research Institute, East Africa's leading medical research facility, is testing the efficiency of an herbal medicine known as Zedupex. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
The search for both a cure and a vaccine for the coronavirus has intensified around the globe, including in Kenya, as medical researchers race to find the elusive remedy. Dr. Festus Stolo of Kenya's Medical Research Institute is the lead scientist tasked with finding out whether a herbal-based drug will be effective against COVID-19. Zedupex, developed in 2015 by Kenyan researchers, has been used in the treatment of herpes. Tolo says his team does not know yet whether the drug will work against the virus.
We are still on very early stages. We cannot be able to really say. Knowing that the herpes simplex virus is a DNA virus and the coronavirus is an RNA virus, this really means that we need to first of all confirm, check whether there is activity before we can be able to really say this is a product which we can explore further for COVID management.
Rudy Eggers is with the World Health Organization. Eggers says that standardizing the various herbal cures could be quite a challenge.
In other medicine, we find that there are very specific levels of the active ingredient in it. And in herbal cures, frequently you find very varied components and then also levels of those components in there. So in fact, you would have to standardize these cures to make sure that you know what is in them and what component is actually acting. So that's quite a step to be taken before you can really evaluate these cures.
Dr. Kefa Bosiri, an ethnobiologist based at the University of Nairobi, also has reservations about traditional cures, saying that mass production could be an issue.
The immediate challenge we would face is getting sufficient quantities of the plant so that we can prepare them to supply the number of patients that may require it on a short notice like we have experienced during this pandemic. So this would require a lot of work to go into identifying the best way to upscale the growing and the collection of these materials.
Despite these hurdles, researchers at KEMRI are pressing ahead with their study of herbal treatments for COVID-19. Kenya itself has seen more than 1,000 confirmed cases of coronavirus disease so far and about 50 deaths. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.